I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to Radio Times. If you're feeling overwhelmed by all that happened in 2014, you are not alone. It was a very busy year. On the domestic front, there was the Senate report on the CIA use of torture on Al-Qaeda suspects. Police shootings and grand jury decisions led to protests across the country. In the summer, there was a migrant crisis on the Texas border. President Obama issued a number of executive orders circumventing Congress, and more states have legalized same-sex marriage and marijuana. On the international front, the U.S. officially ended its combat mission in Afghanistan on Sunday. Obama restored diplomatic relations with Cuba. The rise of ISIS has created yet another crisis in the Middle East. Russia annexed Crimea and invaded Ukraine. Today, we look back at the stories that made headlines with veteran journalists Dick Pullman and Trudy Rubin. We'll also be looking ahead to 2015 and 2016. Dick Pullman is a political columnist for Newsworks.org, writer in residence at the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing. That's at the University of Pennsylvania. Dick Pullman, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
Also with us, as I said, Trudy Rubin. She writes the Philadelphia Inquirer's World View column, and it runs in the paper on Thursdays and Sundays. And Trudy, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be here.
I do want to start with some good news, because there is some, if not bad news, certainly troubling news or unsettling news. But let me start with you, Dick Pullman. What's on the top of your good news list for 2014?
Well, we have low gas prices.
We do have low gas prices.
That's nothing necessarily that President Obama has done, although he did get blamed by the Republicans when the gas prices were high. And that is, I think, that affects people almost as a de facto tax cut right now during the travel season. So I would put that as near the top of the list. I would say the Ebola scare that we had a few months ago in America kind of withered away. Nobody's talking about it really anymore. I think that's probably a testament to our public health system and the CDC actually working. You mentioned same-sex marriage.
Yep.
That may not strike a lot of our, maybe some of our listeners as good news, but I think if we're talking in terms of marriage equality, I think it's now 35 states. There's a big Supreme Court case coming up, of course, that we need to talk about a little bit later, but I would put those in good news. And the economy seems to be doing well, and the Dow broke 18,000, which doesn't help everybody, but everybody seems to be saying that business investment is up, and that the bullish cycle that we've all been waiting for apparently is here.
How about for you, Trudy? She gives me this funny little grin.
On the other hand,
it's your job to talk about the rest of the world.
I have to say that. On the foreign side, a couple of things Dick mentioned, I think, are the only bright spots in terms of foreign policy. Lower energy costs helps the United States in general, but the lower price of oil does undercut some of those who are causing some of the most in-your-face global problems right now, especially Mr. Putin. It does not mean, however, that he is going to really change his foreign policy. That's the unfortunate part. But it does mean he has to think differently, and there might be some changes. Lower oil prices also affect things in the Middle East as well. It affects Iran, which may have an impact on whether or not we get a nuclear treaty on their nuclear program, constricting it. Lower energy costs, although there's some downsides, basically, mm-hmm. Lower oil costs is good for foreign policy. And a stronger U.S. economy, I think, is good because it allows the U.S. to project a more convincing image at a time when the U.S. image has really been sinking. I don't know whether you'd call the Cuba recognition good news. I think it was the right thing to do. It's certainly interesting news. There's a lot of people in the United States who are just slavering over the thought of being able to go down and buy 1950s Chevys.
Right,
but isn't going to happen for a while.
Right. Interesting news. Let me ask you, Dick, about President Obama. And interestingly, his executive orders, apparently there were something like 80 executive actions that he took this year. He seems to be kind of maybe unconnected from having to run again, certainly, but mm-hmm. perhaps thinking about his own legacy and moving without worrying about his own party or even what the Republicans are going to say about his actions?
Well, I think he feels freed up. I couldn't help thinking of the Chris Christopherson line, freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. And I think he's kind of in that kind of mode right now. We saw that in his last press conference. The executive orders, I mean, he can't do as much as he'd like to do. Needless to say, needs more sort of congressional cooperation. But the movements that he's made on, say, immigration and on the environment, executive orders in terms of trying to sort of go after climate change through the EPA, for example. These are things that are broadly popular, I think, with the American people if you look at the polls. And they also go to – I think they help sort of – his agenda and the things he wants to do also, I think, speaks to a potential 2016 Democratic coalition. You know, Hispanic voters are extremely important to winning five or six states now. And the immigration order has boosted his popularity among Hispanics, and that can easily be transferable, I think, to a Democratic candidate. The environmental initiatives also, I think, speak especially to, you know, I mean, upscale educated voters who really care a lot about that, and they tend to vote Democratic in presidential years, or they have in the last few cycles. So I think he's doing things, I think, that are sort of addressing his what he wants to be his legacy and also laying some political groundwork for other Democrats.
But executive actions tend to be temporary, so they can be undone by whoever the next president is.
Yeah, so I think what's going to be interesting in his State of the Union speech, which is January 20th, I believe, this year, next year, is what can he say to a newly Republican Congress, both chambers, that sort of goes beyond whatever his executive orders are? Are there some grounds for cooperation?
You know, Trudy, and looking around the world, of course, there are just seem to be, you know, crises or out-and-out warfare happening in key parts of the country. Is there an Obama doctrine, or should there be an Obama doctrine to deal with the variety of kinds of conflicts that we see, whether it's in the Middle East, whether it's in parts of Africa, for instance?
I think it's very hard to have an overarching doctrine at a time when there are parts of the world that are literally falling apart, as in the Middle East, and countries that are, that big word, revanchist.
What does that mean? I forget.
Looking backward, what strikes me so dramatically is that you have parts of the world that can't stand where the world is today and are looking backward in history before the 20th century, really. You have a Russia that's looking back to the past of a czarist empire, and you have Islamic movement in the Middle East looking back to the 7th century because all the isms of the past 100 years have failed. So I think it's very hard to have an overarching doctrine. I think what is missing is an intense focus. I think that Obama simply didn't want to, and was dragged into focusing on foreign policy to the extent that he should have been from the beginning, and that his team has never been up to the job. So whether or not you could have an overarching philosophy, I think you had to believe that the United States still had a critical role to play, if not as the sole superpower, because the world is changing, then that as a critical factor in almost every region, whether or not you could do what you used to do, you still had a very important role. And I don't think he was convinced of that at the beginning. He wanted to lead from behind, and that just wasn't a schlock phrase. He was hoping that there would be more partnerships, that international rules could be strengthened. And at this time of flux in the world, those hopes did not pan out.
Well, what I thought was interesting yesterday is kind of buried in the headlines was this. It was a ceremony sort of ending our official presence in Afghanistan. Now, there, I think there are 10,000 troops are going to stay on for another year. But nonetheless, what is this, the official end of a 13-year, maybe 13-year war, the longest war we've ever had? Not big banner headlines, kind of buried in the news.
Well, it could come back. I mean, here again, the role that the U.S. has and should have had, and it's harder now because of what wasn't done in the first 6 years of the Obama term, is as a stabilizer, as an aggressive diplomatic organizer. And the U.S. hasn't played that role. So if you simply had a vacuum in Afghanistan, if the United States simply had pulled up and literally gone home, which isn't what we've done, we're going to leave a small troop presence there, then you have a chaotic situation where everyone rushes in and there is no outside power or internal power capable of stabilizing the situation. That's what has happened in Syria. So the U.S. still has a critical role to play. Mm-hmm. The powers in the region are still looking to see what the United States will do. So just because officially we've gone home doesn't mean, for example, that it isn't critical for us to try to encourage a government in Afghanistan to work more effectively or encourage the Pakistanis to do the right thing and go after terrorism. And we still have leverage if we know how to use it.
Well, what's interesting, Dick, is and I think understandably so much of the American public is, you know, opposed to another intervention in another part of the world, that's sort of the message that the public sends to the president or to Congress.
Well, I mean, Obama was elected on with the wind at his back to end the Iraq war and end the Afghanistan war and to pull us out. And so that was in part his mandate. That's how he got to Hillary Clinton's left with the party, and that's where the party was. So, you know, I can see, I mean, Trudy was just talking about the ambivalence within the administration. I mean, I think that has been played out. He was clearly late on ISIS and said something to the New Yorker last winter about it being the junior varsity team, and then the White House tried to walk back those comments and couldn't and shouldn't have. So all that's going on. But what's interesting is the ambivalence is also being played out in both parties, and I think we'll see some of that in 2015 because the Republicans have their own debate going on right now. Rand Paul has, of course, been very, very vocal, and I think he's planning to run for president. About sort of pulling back on intervention around the world. And so a lot of the Republicans who are sort of the traditional muscular foreign policy types have been clashing with him. And so I think that's, the Republicans aren't quite sure either how to play that out for a domestic audience.
Let's take a very short break. And I know, Trudy, you want to add something. We are looking back at the year 2014 when it comes to international news and domestic news. Dick Pullman, political columnist for WHYY's newsworks.org. And again, writer in residence at the Center for Programs and Contemporary Writing at the University of Pennsylvania. Also with us, Trudy Rubin writes the Philadelphia Inquirer's Worldview column. It runs on Thursdays and Sundays, and we bring them together often a couple of times year just to talk about the world that we live in. And we want to hear from you. What do you think are the important news stories of 2014? 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Trudy Rubin and Dick Pullman about the interesting times that we live in. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Again, we're looking back at the year 2014. Much happened during this year. We will be looking ahead to 2015 and can't avoid presidential politics 2016 as well. So we want to hear from you. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Trudy, you wanted to weigh in, and we're sort of mixing together presidential politics and domestic politics and certainly international policy as well.
Yeah, what I wanted to say is that I think there is a paradigm out there on U.S. involvement that has become false, but people still cling to it. It is either we come home, the Rand Paulist approach, and everything will be okay, or we go out there with guns blazing and send ground troops. I think even John McCain, Senator McCain, who's been traveling, is understanding now that the ground troops part may not be the key piece, but that doesn't mean you don't send special forces or advisors. people forget so quickly that when there was a Cold War, you had a certain stability in the world because two superpowers faced off. Then there was the unipolar moment under Clinton when America seemed so omnipresent and omnipotent that was a stabilization factor. Now, so many different things are in play in the world. And when the United States pulls back, it contributes to a growing chaos. For example, in Iraq, where we spent so much blood and treasure because we didn't pay attention. And we just accepted Prime Minister Maliki, a man who did Iran's bidding and pursued a sectarian approach to the country, alienating Sunnis. ISIS grew out of that U.S. Just ignoring the situation. And when Obama finally caught on, we helped create a change there, not interfering in their politics, but encouraging using our leverage, interfering to an extent, mm-hmm. and got a prime minister who may reach out to Sunnis, and the only way to get rid of ISIS is if the Sunnis in Iraq are brought back into the system and turn against ISIS, whom they don't like but they see as their only hedge against Shiite and Iranian domination. That is the kind of role that the U.S. has to play. We still have leverage in the region. We need to back those forces, which are for stability. If we fail to do that, ISIS can become a global threat, which it doesn't have to be, if we pay attention. And that is why there is an important role out there that is short of sending massive troops back to Afghanistan or Iraq, but takes a kind of attention and investment that I'm not sure the Rand Paul is so willing to make.
Looks like you want to say something. I'm going to put something else on the table. Anything you want to add to that, Dick?
No, I was just musing over the frustrating notion that, what Colin Powell said famously said to the White House people, if you break it, you own it. So they broke it for reasons that were non-existent, toppling Hussein for weapons of mass destruction that didn't exist, et cetera. And then we own it, and then so first we break it, and then we walk away from owning it. And so, so you can see what the impulse to pull back ironically comes from, well, we made that horrible mistake in the first place. So, so we kind of lose on both ends, if that makes sense.
Right. But it isn't.
Just quickly. Go ahead.
I was going to say, it isn't just the Iraq War. The Iraq War has precipitated a lot. But you have movements that ultimately are very threatening. For example, ISIS is spreading out to Pakistan, which is ripe for that kind of thing. Now, Pakistan has a new commander-in-chief who seems to get it, finally, that terrorism is a bigger problem than India. But we have to play a role there supporting this, backing this. These things are linked. And if we don't pay attention, then it's not just on account of Iraq, because the world is in flux. We're going to get a much bigger terrorist problem that really bites us.
Let me put something else on the table. And this was the Senate report on the CIA use of torture. And the Senate report talks about torture. I mean, uses that word. These are of al-Qaeda suspects, happened under the Bush administration. Dick, this was a long time coming, this report, a lot of back and forth between even the Obama White House and the CIA and even the Senate committee on this report. How significant do you think this report is? Do you think it's going to go anywhere? Is it going to make changes?
Well, I can't help but notice that, the Senate Democrats put it out. And Republicans were saying either it shouldn't have been released or it was a partisan, quote-unquote partisan report. So that leads me to think that now that Congress is turning over in 2015, that it's not going to ultimately change all that much. I think the report is valuable because it kind of makes us look at the existential question of who we are as a people and what are our values and are we undercutting our own values and are we any different from the enemy. But I think you've got a very strong perspective, a point of view out there that's basically saying that, that whatever we do, it's still it's a bad, maybe a bad means to still our ends are different from the enemy's ends, and that we have to do whatever we can to keep ourselves safe. I mean, you don't have to be Dick Cheney to be making that argument. And so if we have this fight going forward, like as Trudy describes, and we're battling some extremely bad actors out there, I still think there's going to be an argument for that. We have to torture is, you know, a terrible word, and the methods are bad. But there's still going to be an argument out there for doing whatever it takes to keep Americans safe. And I think we're still going to hear a lot of that in the 2016 campaign dialogue.
But I'm also thinking even institutionally, according to the Senate report, the CIA kept the Senate in the dark about certain things that they were doing, perhaps even lied about certain mm-hmm. things that they were doing, and the White House as well. It seems to me is beyond politics. It's about how our government is supposed to operate. Certainly with the CIA that gets to operate in secret.
Well, I don't want to talk like a conspiracy theorist or anything like that. But you know, I think to some extent we have a democratically elected government, and we have a shadow government that's not elected, and that we don't really know what they're doing. You know, there's a permanent national security state kind of like another layer above, perhaps, our democratic elected government. And I think that's just – I think facts at this point bear that out, for better or worse.
Trudy, anything you want to add to that?
Well
– it's all very depressing. But go ahead.
This emerged in a situation of a terrible terrorist attack. Terrorism going forward, for the moment, as ISIS gathers strength, I think the attacks are largely going to be elsewhere, and you're going to have much grimmer methods used by countries where those attacks are taking place, as in Pakistan, Afghanistan, other countries in the Middle East. Yes, the CIA will be involved there. I have to say, I think that it is good that this debate is coming out. My fear is that apart from the torture issue, and it's a big issue, the CIA is not competent enough. I think there is a need for a functional intelligence agency. But having watched on the ground from what I could see for the last decade and a half, you know, I wish the CIA were better at what it did. I'm not talking about torture.
No.
I'm talking about intelligence collection. And, I don't want to see the CIA wrecked. I want to see it improved.
And that's Trudy Rubin, who joins us along with Dick Pullman. We're talking about some of the news stories of 2014 and looking ahead to the future. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We have a tweet from Jim. He says the biggest news is cannabis legalization in Alaska, Oregon, and Washington, D.C. And it's interesting. I mean, interesting segue, Dick, only because we're talking about torture. And, you know, for a lot of people, it's how they want to live their life.
That's right. On the weekends. That trend, I mean, the cannabis reform, if you want to call it that, kind of unites in some ways maybe liberals with libertarian conservatives who basically say government should leave me alone. Plus the fact that I think one of the things that's helped it gather steam is the fact that there's tax revenue and a lot of states are pinched. And so Colorado, where it's been legal now for at least a year, its projections of tax revenue keep ratcheting up. And so one of the things that helped the Democratic governor get reelected in a close race in November was on the eve of the election, all of a sudden this new tax revenue came in, and they were able to sort of earmark it for the schools and school construction. A lot of projections on whether a lot of young people were going to use it or whether crime was going to go up have not borne out. So I think we are going to see more of that. The problem with the Washington, D.C. one, by the way, which we have to note, even though over 70% of the citizens voted for this to make it legal, is that Washington, D.C. is still trumped by Congress the way it's run, right? It's in the Constitution. And so the Republican Congress has been trying to put a halt on the legalization in the district. And so that's still going to take a while before we know what happens there.
You know, Trudy, you sometimes wonder whether we just want to run our government's programs on gambling and on marijuana, you know, whether we could have a country like that.
Well, actually – My mind jumped to another topic because the marijuana was off point. And in a way, the big news story of 2014 that we may remember long after others is North Korea's attack on Sony. And if you want to see that as good news, it has struck me over and over again since this happened that in this case, it was a rogue state attacking a movie company, which was almost funny and food for satire, even though it was very serious. What it did was remind us that the biggest threat to the United States in the coming years, assuming we can take care of ISIS or that it won't grow exponentially, is the fact that this revealed if North Korea could do this. Imagine what China's doing it commercially, but imagine how an enemy state that was truly capable could take out our electricity systems, you know, undo the Pentagon and so forth and so on. We've known this, but I think this brought it to the fore in the public's mind.
So seeing a Seth Rogen movie, Dick Pullman becomes an act of patriotism, yeah, right?
You know,
I have to admit, well, I watch it with my family over the weekend.
And
totally silly.
I just heard it's
totally
pretty
silly
juvenile
movie.
From what I've heard. But,
absolutely,
you know, freedom of expression means that you have to defend the bad stuff as well as the
but
great
you know,
stuff.
But you know what's funny? I mean, I got an email from Fleming Rose, one of the editors of the Danish paper.
They
published
sure.
the cartoons. What's really ironic is that this has become a big issue with unequivocal support, you know, for Sony and freedom of speech. But when it came to the Muhammad cartoons, everybody was wishy-washy and waffling. The Inquirer was one of only four papers in the United States that ran one of the cartoons, and we were attacked for it. And I think we have to think about this. Who are we willing to see censor us? Because this silly movie is in awful taste. You know, you wouldn't want to see a movie about blowing up President Obama. And the Muhammad cartoons were in awful taste from our point of view. But we were willing to many papers were willing to censor us out of fear. It wasn't really that they weren't willing to criticize religion. It was fear that somebody would attack them. And so I think the North Korea Sony issue also reminds us that there's an element of blackmail here. And you can laugh at Kim Jong-un, but when it's fear of being blown up, you know, what if Islamic State says, you know, don't run this show? Maybe now we'd laugh, but it could become dangerous once the first bomb goes off. So you have to think about what defending freedom of speech will mean in the future.
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. We have Rick from Warminster joining us from Radio Times. Hi, Rick. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, fine. Thanks a lot for taking my call.
You're
welcome. You have a wonderful show.
Oh, thank you.
I think this one spans the geopolitical situation. I'm a retired colonel, 26 years, Vietnam and the Gulf War. I look back at treaties like NATO, over 60 years old, and we look at places that are not even contiguous with the European members of that NATO, and we have burden sharing, and we have them contributing 200 or 300 soldiers here and there and everything else. When do we ever have a review of these treaties? When do we ever look at burden sharing? And when do we ever take a look at our budget and our foreign aid to 190 countries when 75% of the aid to those countries goes to two countries, Israel and Egypt?
Rick, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. What I hear him saying, Trudy, is that we're operating under treaties that predate, you know, most of our lives, actually, and whether that makes sense to operate in the world like that today.
Well, I think the colonel has raised several important questions. I mean, when it comes to NATO, you know, when the Soviet Union collapsed, NATO was looking for new missions. So you could ask whether NATO has outlived its usefulness. I think it's useful simply as a vehicle for holding Europeans together with the United States. I still think that's important because there is a confluence of values. And we tended to think in the last couple of decades that democracy was forever. But now there are new approaches, new authoritarianism rising that actually attack democracy as an ideology and present themselves as an alternative. And I think it's important to have that transatlantic relationship. But that does raise the question about, do you want to extend NATO to Georgia, even to Ukraine? And that's, those are really important issues. I don't think we want to, but we do have to look at that. You know, foreign aid, yes, I do think it has to be rethought. I think that foreign aid outside of humanitarian aid, I do believe has to be used more effectively and not simply handed out to governments that spit on us.
Well, and this is a weird segue to you, Dick Pullman. I'm interested in your thoughts about how Republicans and Democrats in Congress are going to deal with each other once 2015 rolls around.
I think what the what the Republicans need to do more than anything, now that they're going to have complete control on the Hill, is to they have to demonstrate to the voters, swing voters, that they can govern responsibly and affirmatively. You know, before it was all, you know, let's not do this. Let's stop Obama from the – and we're still getting some of that rhetoric, of course, around stopping Obamacare, repealing it. But all that is, I think, just sort of rhetorical nods to the conservative base. But what McConnell – Mitch McConnell has been talking about a lot has been, you know, we can't just make a point and send a message. We have to actually do things that are affirmative. So I think what their challenge is for the next year, year and a half is to look for – from their perspective, would be like center-right policies, and I'm going to try to think of a few, that also have broad public appeal. And so, and you put those on Obama's desk and dare him to veto them, and if he vetoes them, then they can still say this is what the American people want. There are some examples, but I think it's their main challenge.
And that's Dick Pullman, who joins us along with Trudy Rubin, looking back at 2014, looking ahead as well. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Rick, thanks for calling in. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow. I'm talking with Trudy Rubin. She writes the Philadelphia Inquirer's Worldview column. It appears on Thursdays and Sundays. Also with us is Dick Pullman, political columnist for WHYY's newsworks.org. And we are talking about the news of 2014, the headlines of 2014, and as always, looking ahead to 2015 and beyond. We want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times about the important news stories that struck you this year. Dick, we didn't really finish up with the Democrats. I mean, they lost badly in November, we should say. Many of them did not want to be seen in the same picture frame as the president. I don't know if that was a smart thing or not a smart thing for them to do. Seems like they ran some pretty mediocre candidates, if I can say that. Mm-hmm. Do you think the Democratic Party has some soul searching to do?
Absolutely. And, I was just saying before the break what the Republicans need to do. Well, what the Democrats need to do is particularly on the Hill in their reduced numbers, is to figure out what they're all about. Because you have now you have two distinct factions in some ways. Elizabeth Warren is sort of leading kind of like a liberal, populist, anti-corporate group within the party, and you know, made a big speech in November, I think it was, where she was basically saying, "I'm calling it the enough is enough speech." And this is when there was like a pro Wall Street thing that was written by some people on Wall Street, got slipped into the big spending bill at the last second, which allows Wall Street people to sort of gamble again with taxpayer money on risky derivatives, and then get bailed out if they screw up. And that's the kind of thing that a lot of people in the progressive wing of the party, the base, if you will, really, really care about that. And she, I don't necessarily think she's running for president, but I think she's going to have a very strong voice in the next 2 years. And it's going to be interesting to see how Hillary Clinton, presumably, who's going to presumably announce in the next few months, is going to try to sort of tell the left side of the party, you know, that I understand what the average person's concerns are vis-a-vis, you know, the corporate powers who still control a lot of the party.
Do you see, I mean, Bernie Sanders apparently is making noises about running for president.
Yeah.
I mean, do you see them as the sort of girl-boy version of, you know, of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party?
Yeah, I mean, I think if he's in the debates, and also James Webb, who we haven't mentioned, who's actually the one who's taken the strongest steps on the Democratic side, and he's former Democratic senator from Virginia, right, who actually in some ways does talk sort of a non-intervention. He's a former military guy who talks non-interventionist rhetoric, and he also is sort of populist on the left. I think it would be great if we had those three in debates. Hillary Clinton needs to be challenged, needs to focus whatever her message is going to be. And I think Bernie is probably going from a – it would be great to have sort of like a thoroughgoing socialist on the stage, if for no other reason, just to sort of broaden out the dialogue.
Indeed. Let me ask you about Russia and Putin. And you were in Ukraine earlier this year, Trudy,
right,
and have written a lot about what's going on in that part of the world. You have described Putin as a global menace. What are his designs? I mean, is it to sort of create the Russia of yesteryear?
You know, as is widely known, Putin described the breakup of the Soviet Union as one of the greatest geopolitical tragedies of the 20th century. And I think he is now wedded to a religious nationalism harking back to the remembered glories of the Tsarist Empire. Some cynically might well say this is simply a vehicle to hold on to power. However, I'm beginning to believe that he has sold himself on this because he is pursuing such a destructive path for his own country. It is staggering to look at the decrease in foreign investment, even before sanctions, because of Putin's centralization, destruction of private enterprise, renationalization of energy companies, mismanagement. A country which should be one of the leaders in intellectual talent, given that they used to have a good education system and a lot of scientists, has just fallen off the charts, and therefore they live off of oil. And with decreasing oil prices, one would think that Putin would see the light. I think this is a key to what will happen in Ukraine. It is possible that he might pull back and give up his idea of moving further into Ukraine because of the falling oil prices, but he still obviously is going to try to destabilize the country. It's a religious nationalism that I think he's auto-hypnotized himself with.
Oh, interesting. Hypnotize himself.
Yes, because I think Putin is a former KGB senior officer, well, actually mid-level. And one thing at the top, the KGB knew more about the realities of Russia than almost anybody else because they had access to information that other people didn't have. Putin has to know about the dire economic situation of his country and not simply because of falling oil prices. And yet he is pursuing a path that is so destructive and blaming all the country's problems on the West. And I have to believe as a rational KGB man, he's not just doing that to sell it to his own people, that he's lost some of that KGB rationality and has sold himself on a lie.
Dick, we have a comment from Kate in Morristown. Says, in terms of national news stories, I think we need to focus on the war on drugs. Prohibition in the 30s clearly didn't work, and the U.S. really needs to rethink its drug policies. Do you think the country is beginning to rethink some of these drug policies and the fact that people have gotten locked up for instance, small amounts of marijuana? Some of this is happening on a local level, but
right,
but nonetheless.
Well, we mentioned marijuana before, and obviously beyond that, I think what's interesting is that the Republican – this is one area we talk about Democratic and Republican cooperation. There's actually a faction in both – there are people in both parties who have begun to look at the severity of mandatory sentencing for small drug offenses. And I know outgoing Attorney General Eric Holder was talking about this a few months ago. I remember writing about it, where they're basically saying, this is not proportionate with the crime, and so we are breeding new criminals by locking them up, and whereas they should be other ways of sort of dealing with. And this is all, these are drug-related crimes. And so I think there is some rethinking there where it does cross ideological lines, and I think that's a hopeful sign.
Trudy, we have a comment from Elizabeth in West Philadelphia saying, I'm concerned about the Pentagon spending and the potential rise in nuclear weapons in the U.S. Can they address that? Nuclear weapons. I mean, this is something that the president has been working on. Certainly, you mentioned Iran.
Right. Well, I mean, the president has been trying hard to lower the number of nuclear weapons. And actually, there had been some progress in talks with Russia. And it is Putin who is backing off of that. I mean, the U.S. had done very good work with the Russians also on safeguarding nuclear material in Russia because there was a tremendous sloppiness about demobilized nuclear missiles, demobilized nuclear subs. Really shocking. And the U.S. contributed a lot, both in money and technology. And the Russians, again, have pulled back from that. So I think Obama has been on the right track on attempting to curb proliferation and safeguard nuclear material. But he's a lonely voice in the wilderness.
Well, what about Pakistan? And I mean,
yeah, Pakistan continues to produce more fissile material and, excuse me, more nuclear weapons, excuse me, at a faster rate, I believe, than any other country. And they are extremely touchy. We have offered to help with safeguards, and they reject our help.
Well, that's a little worrisome. Let me get Amy from Bella Vista to join us. Amy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Thanks for a really interesting and wide-ranging discussion.
Thank you. I have to say
I'm very disappointed to have heard only the barest mention of really what's the most profound and important issue ever to face the human race. I mean, I hate to sound sort of overly dramatic, but you barely mentioned climate change. And to start the discussion with a discussion of low gas prices and to talk about all of the implications of low, I should say some of the implications of low gas prices in terms of the domestic economy, in terms of Putin, in terms of the Middle East, and not to talk about the most important implication, which is what that's going to mean for ongoing climate change, it's very disappointing.
Well, let me just give Dick Pullman a shout out, Amy, because he did mention that, and he did mention the fact that the president has used some of his executive authority to deal with some of the issues of climate change. But I agree with you; it's a very important story. Let me give Dick a chance to expand on that.
I could certainly elaborate. some of the moves that the president's made on this, talking a lot more, doing executive orders that are aimed at reducing carbon emissions, is very dovetails very strongly with where the majority of the American people are, and where 97% of scientists are. And I think what's going to be interesting going into 2015 is an increasing challenge, I think, to Republicans to what is their response to that? Are they still going to hew to this argument that man-made climate change is some kind of myth? And what's going to happen when we have Republican candidates on stage, on the presidential debate stage, starting in 2015, by the way, sometime in mid-year, and if there are going to be questions about that, are they all going to sort of raise their hand and say, yeah, no, I don't believe that there's man-made climate change? And how is that going to play with, you know, swing voters who I think recognize reality? Are they going to be able to – are they going to dig in their heels and really risk – their political prospects.
Amy, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me make a segue to the Keystone XL pipeline, which has, I think it's been 5 years in under discussion. It's this curious thing, Trudy, because it does involve the State Department, because it involves oil. This is very dirty oil, apparently, coming from Canada through the middle of the United States down to Texas. If I can go back to you, Dick, only because you wrote something recently about Obama, in a sense, I guess, kind of kicking this can down the road. This is this thing he does not want to touch.
Well, it's interesting because we're talking about the majority of American people in polls. It's also true the majority or a landslide majority supports the Keystone Pipeline. And so he's kind of you know, people are broadly pro-environment, but there's also support for that because people are still thinking about oil supply, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, I'm wondering, and I just ask this as an open question, excuse me, how much the – what kind of bearing the lower oil prices and the fact that we've got enough oil, you know, how is that – is that going to sort of dilute the urgency of passing the Keystone Pipeline? The Republicans want to bring it up as part of the bill early in this in the new year.
And kind of force the president either to sign it or to veto it.
Yeah, if he vetoes it, are they going to say, oh, he's standing in the way of jobs, right, even though there's very few permanent jobs?
Do you have a thought on this, Trudy?
you know, the Keystone Pipeline interests me less than the concept that I think those who care about climate change, about who environment, there's real serious debates that people have about trade-offs because the need for energy is not going to go away. You know, I happen to be very glad that shale gas is making the United States less dependent on the Middle East. You know, where you stand depends on where you sit. I'm looking at terrorist threats and so forth. But there's a very interesting story out of Germany, which has been in the forefront as a country about trying to use alternative energy means. They banned nuclear. They're trying to downscale on coal. But there's just been a rebellion on installing lines that have to do with turbines, and because people don't want them in their backyard. There have to be trade-offs. Either you do nuclear, or gas is cleaner, but it also has its other problems. Or, I mean, there has to be, I think, a realistic assessment here of trade-offs. You can't do no energy. And I don't think we are realistic about that debate. I mean, maybe environmentalists should be pushing, like anything, for more safety regulations on fracking. But there has to be...
And I think they are.
But I think you can't have no energy. And so then the question is, how can you have the safest and cleanest? And it isn't all going to be wind turbines.
Well, and having been in Germany this summer, it was amazing how many wind turbines there were. I mean, just every hill you
crossed. But now they're having this reaction. And after the latest Japanese calamity and Angela Merkel, you know, the public wanted to ban nuclear. You know, you're left struggling to find a way. And I'm all for conservation. But in the end, industrial countries need some kind of power sources. And I sometimes think the debate has to be more realistic.
Well, we have about a minute before we have to say goodbye. And to you, Dick, I guess sort of looking ahead into 2015, and I guess you indicated the fact that we will hear pretty soon about whether Hillary's going to run. I mean, it's hard to imagine that she's not. Mm-hmm. And I guess whether Bush is going to get into the race. You mentioned Rand Paul. Chris Christie, do you think he's an option?
Well, I think this may strike –
that's a chuckle from Trudy, by the way.
This may strike people as depressing. I don't know. But we may end up in 2016 with the House of Clinton versus the House of Bush. And how does that sound to you?
I don't know.
Sounds like we're looking backward to the 20th century, whereas Putin is going to the 19th and ISIS to the 7th.
Back to the future. Right. I think Hillary's going to run because I think if she wasn't, I think she would have already said so, to clear ground for these other people to sort of get better known. So I think we're going to see that soon enough. Her key thing is, what is she running on? What is her key theme? What's her driving message beyond just it's her turn? I don't think that's enough. She actually had that same problem in 08 as well.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you. Happy New Year. Thanks for coming in and joining us today on Radio Times. Dick Pullman, political columnist for WHYY's newsworks.org and writer in residence at the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing at the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you, Dick, for coming in. Trudy Rubin, thank you very much as well. She writes the Philadelphia Inquirer's Worldview column, and it runs on Thursdays and on Sundays. Actually wrote a book a bunch of years ago, Willful Blindness, The Bush Administration in Iraq. We talked about that quite a bit. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program, including how to download podcasts of the show, how to find us on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.